Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. Joined today by no one because I am sitting here in my study on my own. We are all working remotely. The office is shut. Everyone is working at home. Yesterday we tried to get the magazine out. We did get the magazine out without actually being present in the office for the first time ever. It was a huge challenge. 14 hours at the kitchen table on top of 10 hours the day before. Difficult times for us, but more difficult for many other people. And that is why we've chosen this week to focus on the healthcare side of things. Our former colleague Megan Boxall has now rejoined the Investors Chronicle, and she has written the cover feature this week looking at how the pharmaceutical industry, the healthcare industry more generally, is responding to this crisis and what the long-term implications could be for that sector and, in fact, healthcare in general. It's a great feature, and I'll be speaking to her about that very shortly. And then I'll be speaking to Phil about some of the continuing economic effects of this crisis, and in particular the government's response, and what that means for markets generally, and whether it's going to be enough to deal with a problem of this magnitude. First of all, let's turn to healthcare and Megan Boxall. Welcome back to the Investors Chronicle and the podcast, Megan. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be back, albeit from a distance.
Yeah, it's a very strange way we're recording this. You've picked a great time to come back to us, but I'm glad you have, because before you left, you wrote a lot about healthcare, and that's obviously one of the pressing concerns at the centre of this crisis we're living at the moment. So you've written the cover feature this week, Fight Back, which is about the companies that are looking to find solutions to either curing or vaccinating against or diagnosing coronavirus COVID-19, and what that means for investors. So, where do you start with this?
I think where we're at in terms of the disease.
Should we go through the numbers? I mean, they're a bit scary, but tell us what they are and what they mean.
They're a bit scary, and also they're changing so quickly. So by the time people are listening to this, they're probably higher, but they can be checked all the time online. We're currently at the time of recording at 227,505 cases worldwide and just over 9,000 deaths. They're only, and this is, I think, the most important thing to talk about in terms of what those numbers actually mean, only what we know. The number of people who've got coronavirus may be much, much higher, and that would be a really good thing. To say, well, this is only the tip of the iceberg, that would be great. If it turns out that loads and loads of people have got coronavirus and just not known about it, that'd be great, because it means that actually there are people whose symptoms have never been bad enough to be tested. Yeah, the numbers are scary, but they do need to be taken in context. For sure.
So the context you've chosen to focus on in the feature is the comparison with the sort of normal winter flu, which obviously kills a lot of people as well.
Yeah, it does. And the average in the UK is about 17,000, which that's a huge number. But it does make the 20,000 people that might die from coronavirus seem a little bit less scary. The issue is obviously the death rate at the moment. The confirmed death rate is extraordinarily high. It's just under 4%. But that is based on confirmed cases. So if that is the correct stat, if everyone who gets the disease, 4% of those people will die, then yeah, we need to make sure as few people as possible get the disease. But actually, if the number is much higher than that, which it probably is, who've been infected, the death rate is gonna be much lower. And it may actually be more like the normal flu is, which is 0.1%. So that would be a really good sign. But obviously we need to get there first. We need to find out exactly how many people have had coronavirus and not known about it.
Diagnostics, we'll come on to that. I guess what you're talking about, the fact that people may have had this already and not known about it or had only very mild symptoms, is part of the reason why this is such a big concern. So people are what they call asymptomatic. So people can go about their daily business spreading this without even knowing, why the reaction has been what it has been in terms of what the authorities are doing.
Yeah, and I think we've had two pretty major government policies, two completely different policies, which the change was made on Monday. So last week, the UK government was saying we want to end up with what's called herd immunity, where enough people have contracted the disease that there aren't enough people left to spread it to. And that works very well for things like the common cold, because the symptoms are not really bad enough to kill people. But you build up an immunity as a group, which means that it stops being spread and the virus is kind of killed off because it's got nowhere else to go to. And that's fine if for a disease where the symptoms aren't bad enough, but for a disease which the coronavirus could be, we don't know yet for sure, but it could be killing 4% of the people who've got it. We definitely don't want to be allowing 60% of the UK population to be getting coronavirus if it is then going to be killing 4% of those people.
So that's why the government policy has changed in the last week.
So the government policy changed based on some research which came out of Imperial College London, which was based on numbers from both Italy and from China, which are obviously, China is about 6 weeks ahead of us. Italy's about 3 weeks ahead of us in terms of when the coronavirus hit and how many people are affected. If we're looking at China now, China's actually extremely positive. China didn't have any new cases, domestic cases reported yesterday. That was the first day that they didn't have any new ones, which that's amazing. There is hopefully a light at the end of the tunnel, but we do have to get through the Italy stage first. What the government is doing with its current policy, keeping people indoors, shutting schools, trying to avoid as much contact as possible, is trying to avoid the Italy situation, the complete overwhelming situation on hospitals, on the healthcare service, on individuals, because what's happening in Italy at the moment is quite grim, and we just don't want to be there.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess that's about the ability of the healthcare system to cope. So this is what the government is trying to avoid, that the NHS becoming swamped with cases to the point that it can't treat people, and that's when people start to die.
Yeah. Exactly.
Should we talk about some of the responses that the pharmaceutical industry is taking? There's several strands to this: treating the illness itself, vaccination to prevent people getting the illness in the first place, and working out who's actually got it, the diagnostic side of things. And then there's some other stuff as well around actually delivery of healthcare, which you talk about in the feature.
Yeah, and delivery of healthcare could be a really long-term trend, a long-term shift. So it's definitely worth looking at some of the companies that are involved in that kind of thing, which we do talk about and we'll continue to talk about in the next few weeks. We're always on the hunt for companies that might be ready to benefit from this, even though benefit's a horrible word at the moment. But there will be companies that will come out of the other side of it maybe better. But for now, the pharmaceutical companies are working on drugs for patients to take while they're in hospital. They're also working on vaccines. GSK is one that is working on a vaccine at the moment. It's got a platform which it's kind of renting out to other pharmaceutical companies, including one in China. This could end up being a really good thing for GSK's vaccines business.
And it's a big part of its business.
It is, yeah.
21% of revenues, I think you say?
21% of revenues, yeah. And it's an incredibly high margin part of the business as well. So a boost to that part could be good for the long-term investment case for GSK.
Lots of companies trying to find a vaccine at the moment, though. And there's some really interesting approaches companies are taking to this. There's some candidates that people seem to have had sort of lurking in their, I think, libraries of research.
Yeah, so drugs that have already been approved are way more likely to be useful during this outbreak of coronavirus, because however close we are to a vaccine, and there is a US company trialing, it's quite a small US company, but it's had some backing from the US government, some financial backing. They've actually started clinical trials into a new vaccine. However good that vaccine is in clinical trials, it is not going to be let out into the market until the safety tests have all been done, because it would be way worse to release this vaccine into the world without it being safety tested first. So actually a far quicker option would be to find a drug which has already been approved, been safety tested, and also works for treating coronavirus.
It's Gilead's drug that people are most excited about, though, isn't it? I won't try and pronounce its name. I can never pronounce the name of drugs.
Neither can I, but a lot of pharmaceutical executive can't either. I was on a call once with the chief executive of AstraZeneca, and he was complaining about these silly names that people are given. So even the people high up, the pharma world, can't say the names of the medicines.
This drug, what's it called? It's
Remdesivir.
Why are people excited about this one in particular?
So it was originally developed to combat Ebola, but it's also proved very effective in the past at treating SARS and MERS, which are both strains of coronavirus. So coronavirus is the whole family of illness, of virus. And the current strain which people are worried about is called SARS-CoV-2. And so early stage tests have found that this drug, this Gilead drug, Remdesivir, also helps with the current strain of virus that people are being affected by. And there was a patient in the US, he was in hospital in Washington, he had pneumonia, and he took medicine and it worked. And now it's being tested in a massive population of people, including in China and Hong Kong and in the US. And because it has already worked on viruses before, and it's been safety tested, it could be rolled out into the hospitals. And it's also produced by a massive pharma company with huge manufacturing. And if this is the drug, they can get it out into the hospitals really, really quickly. So that would be great, because there'd be something else to be helping the people who do end up hospitalized.
So that's not a vaccine, that's a cure, that's a treatment.
That's natural medicine, yeah.
Vaccines are important because this thing might lurk around for a while. So
vaccines are bigger for the long term. And I do think there is going to be a shift in thinking. And we do need to start thinking more about prevention, because our hospital systems around the world, they're just not set up for this kind of thing. And that's what people are worried about most. The fact that if we do have millions of people getting unwell, we can't handle it.
We certainly couldn't handle it. So we can't invest the amount in healthcare systems that would make them bulletproof when stuff like this does happen. We can't afford to shut down the economy time after time after time if things like this happen again. So one of the changes you're most excited about in terms of what COVID could mean for the long-term nature of the healthcare industry is around diagnostics. So working out whether people have something, even if they're asymptomatic, and sort of making sure that testing can prevent sort of a wide-scale breakout of something like this. Why is diagnostics something that excites you? And also, I think you mentioned, angers you in respect of what's going on.
Yeah, the more I read about it, the more angry I get, and I'm going to try and not get too ranty about it, because one of the reasons we're in this situation is because diagnostics has been so overlooked, and it's something that we knew was being overlooked. It's not like, oh, we probably should have done more diagnostics. Everyone knew that diagnostics across the board, not just for infectious diseases, but for things like cancer and all sorts of illnesses, it's not very good, because, and everyone's experienced it, because of the process, the diagnostics process. You go to your GP and you give a blood sample, and then that's sent off in the post, and then it has to go to one of these big kits. So they're made by the big companies like Roche and Siemens and Abbott, and there aren't actually that many of them, and they all have to go to the same place, and then they wait in a queue, and then they go into the machine, and then they get tested, and then they have to send the letter back to your GP, and then you have to go back into the GP. It's a really long-winded process. What needs to happen is there has to be more point-of-care testing. And so when you go into your GP and they take the blood sample, you can get the results there and then. This breakout has really shown why our current way of testing is not good enough. We are currently in the UK only testing patients who've gone into hospitals, which means that if in 6 weeks' time, if a proper test, a point-of-care test, is sent out to, and everyone can test themselves and we can send in our results and it will show whether or not we've had coronavirus. If that is the case, and millions of us have had coronavirus without even noticing, we've potentially put the economy on lockdown for no reason at all.
Mm.
And the reason that that's happened is because when the outbreak started, we weren't able to assess people immediately, and we had to say, you know what, you have to go home, or if you're unwell enough, you have to go into hospital, because we didn't have enough tests. And in the US, Roche has now finally, they've got a kit made which can be used, but it can only be used in these big machines, and they shipped 400,000 units of this kit over the weekend. But 400,000 isn't enough when there's millions of people in the US, and that's just in the US, and no companies have the ability to deal with the volume. And the Roche's kit can test, I think it's something like 400 in 3 hours, which is good. It's much better than it was, but it's still not good enough. So what is needed is a point of care test or a do it at home test. And it's something that actually Donald Trump was talking a lot about yesterday. Self swabs, he kept on saying in his press conference that he called. A lot of his press conference was bluster, but that's something that US diagnostics companies are really focused on, is getting a kit out to as many people as possible so we can actually see what we're fighting. I spoke to a doctor who said that GPs in the UK have been told that they have to work from home, take calls, but they're all preparing to go and start working from hospitals or like makeshift hospitals if the worst comes to the worst.
Brave people.
And they said, yeah, I mean, amazingly brave people, but they say that it feels like they're fighting a war with a blindfold on, with their hands tied behind their backs, because they don't actually know what they're fighting and they haven't got the tools to fight it. So that is something that hopefully now we've had this kick, it will kick the diagnostics companies into action, start really prioritising point of care testing and kits that can be used immediately for cases like this.
I mean, something you mentioned in the feature is that diagnostics as an industry took a bit of a battering because of the Theranos scandal.
Which may be a reason why it has fallen a bit behind, because there hasn't been the investment in it.
Which is a terrible shame. However, I mean, in the companies that you've looked at, there are a lot of companies, including those listed in the UK, that are working. I mean, testing is what they're looking at, diagnostics. And this is, you know, potentially the silver lining of what's happening at the moment is that that these companies have a really, really interesting future, not just, you know, because, you know, testing for COVID-19, but testing for all sorts of things in the future. Do you want to talk us through some of the companies that are working on really interesting solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. So Novacyte is one. It's actually listed in France and on AIM. They've actually designed and developed a test, and it's being shipped out to hospitals. It's actually being tested in hospitals in the UK at the moment. BATM is another one that has developed, and it's got a test for COVID-19 in production. And then there are other diagnostics companies which are point-of-care ones, like EKF, which its whole focus is on point-of-care testing. And if there is going to be more investment and more interest in that, that's great. They should get a real boost. And the other company in the UK, small company in the UK, which is really exposed to diagnostics, is Bioventix. They make the antibodies, which you need antibodies to run a blood test in one of these big machines. But they will, if diagnostics is going to be a much bigger industry, their products are going to be in much higher demand because they make really, really good antibodies. So yeah, there are definitely exciting opportunities, long-term opportunities, not just sort of the ones that are doing something now.
Companies like Novacyte and BATM sound really interesting. What they're doing is really, really exciting. But because they're small companies, they face quite significant challenges, particularly as they're up against, you know, really big companies, and getting up to the scale that they need to is going to be a massive challenge. It doesn't seem like a one-way bet for investors.
No, especially as I think both of these companies have probably enjoyed their big share price rises for the time being, at least. I mean, BATM is up 50% today. And yeah, their diagnostics kits could be very beneficial, but like you say, they are competing now with companies, big companies, which have massive production lines and can roll out those tests much quicker. And Novacyte has had 8 months worth of orders in the last couple of weeks, and it just can't manufacture enough tests quickly enough to satisfy the demands. Obviously, they have potentially got very bright long-term futures, and they've really made a name for themselves. But now they are also takeover targets. They've proven that they can develop these tests very, very quickly, quicker than some of the big ones. I mean, they were both ahead of Roche and Abbott's, and I don't even know what Siemens is doing. But the fact that they've proven that they can do it quickly, bigger companies might be interested in either acquiring them or using them in the future to develop sort of the test in the early stages to find the antibody that's needed, that the very, very early research and development phase before a big company takes over the manufacturing and the final stage development. That might be a win for these companies in the future, but it's by no means a guarantee.
I mean, it all sounds absolutely fascinating. It sounds like it could underpin some quite significant changes in the way the industry works, where the focus lies. And you know, one of the really sort of back to basics things I think you mentioned in the feature is the really simple idea that we should be washing our hands a bit more and cleaning things up a bit better.
I mean, that's crazy. I think people didn't really realize how good soap was. China's healthcare policy changed about 2 years ago, and they're really trying to tick up towards Western medicine, and this is another kick for them, and maybe there will be opportunities in China to start selling more soap and more hospital cleaning products and things like that.
Tristel has been one of the big beneficiaries of this outbreak.
Yeah, and their chief executive has actually already said that this might be a real win for them, which, yeah, it could be. The only issue that I think Tristel might have is that they are still quite a small company, and they've got this product, which is a fantastic product, but it's not like it can't be replicated. And now that China has identified that it needs to be a little bit more hygienic, surely a Chinese company can just start doing what Tristel's doing. And that kind of wipes away Tristel's massive growth market, China. So hopefully Tristel will be able to get its product rolled out in China quickly before companies within China start doing it. But it's a potential risk
I mean, this is all absolutely fascinating. It is a really interesting industry, which perhaps we sort of neglect from time to time, but it's been brought back into focus by this crisis and obviously has a role, a huge role to play in restoring some normality to the world and helping us sort of live better in the future without worrying about this kind of thing. It's really reassuring to hear that all this is happening at a really difficult time for everybody. So, yeah, thank you.
That's okay. Yeah, I think the reassurance thing, obviously, we don't want to be insensitive about what's happening because it is scary, but actually having it in context and knowing that healthcare stuff out there is happening and it's happening quicker than it's ever happened before. They've got a vaccine into clinical trials within 8 weeks, which has never been done before. So hopefully all the bleak outlook won't actually be quite so bleak once this healthcare stuff really gets going, and it is getting going.
And it's good to have you back to write it, Megan.
Good to be back.
Yeah, it's a great feature. Obviously, that's not why we brought you back to write about healthcare. You're actually here in a different role. You're our new education editor. Do you want to tell us what you're going to be doing there?
This is all about identifying potential new investors and new people who hopefully will be interested in the Investors Chronicle and all of the amazing content that's written, and bringing it into a whole new generation of investors. We're trying to see the outlook has changed quite dramatically from the week that I started in the first week of March, and all of a sudden now the markets don't look quite as sunny as they did then, but it doesn't mean that there aren't huge opportunities. I mean, arguably even more so, even if people may have been a little bit freaked out by what's happened in the last few weeks. But this is the time to get going with investment, and hopefully I will help educate that.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. I mean, it certainly doesn't feel like, you know, a good time to get stuck into the markets today necessarily, because we have no idea what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
No, and I completely sympathise with people's worries about that and the fact that maybe they want to hang off a little bit, see what's going to happen. But actually, there are some companies now, some amazing companies, which are going to get through this. And they are significantly cheaper now than they were last month. So
that's true.
It's worth looking out for them. But obviously with a sensible head on, it's not a time to just buy anything, because as we saw with Laura Ashley, not everything is going to survive this.
No, and I think what it has shown as well, what this crisis has shown, is that actually, you know, investing, it's a good thing to do over the long term, but perhaps we have been lulled into a false sense of security about how easy it is. And you actually do have to educate yourself and do the hard yards to make sure you do it properly. Megan, it's brilliant to have you back. And as I said, it's a brilliant feature. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we've heard from Megan talking about the healthcare side of things, and it's quite reassuring to hear that there's quite a lot of activity going on to help find a medical solution to the crisis we're facing, but that doesn't necessarily solve the economic problems immediately. So now I'm going to talk to Phil Oakley to get your sort of latest assessment of where we are in terms of the markets and the economy. How are you doing, Phil?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, John.
Good, glad to hear it. Difficult times. What do you make of it all, Phil?
I think it's difficult for any, you know, to know what to make of it. I think on the one hand, it's welcome that you're seeing governments trying to help out. It's not particularly going out on a limb to say that the central bankers printing money and cutting interest rates have probably run out of bullets now. Something different has to be tried. But it's not just solving the problem caused by shutting down because of the virus. It's all the other problems that have been perhaps forgotten about and hidden away that have reared up again because of it.
What sort of problems are we talking about, Phil?
We still have an economy that is carrying too much debt. And when you've got an economy that carries too much debt, it's very difficult to cut the slack that's needed to get things going again, because too much income is going to service the debt, and so therefore you haven't got as much left over to flow into the real economy and people start buying stuff again.
Okay, so the solution is to pump a lot of government money into addressing this problem, but isn't that just exacerbating the problem? Where is this money coming from?
Yeah, that's a problem. You know, if you just sort of recap on what the UK government come out and said it's going to do. So it's going to basically make £350 billion available. And most of that is actually going to come in the form of guarantees for bank loans. So it's not the government showering businesses with cash. It is for businesses that are struggling with paying rents, paying wages, paying suppliers. It's a way of them accessing cash. And this is in stark contrast to, say, the French government, where President Macron has pretty much tried to guarantee or replace revenue, or the Danish government, which has gone down a pretty similar route. So what a lot of British businesses are faced with, particularly in sectors, the leisure, hospitality, retail, pubs and bars, the revenue for these kind of businesses is gone, pretty much gone. And you're being asked to replace that revenue, and usually that revenue comes with some profit with it, and you use that profit to pay your wages and pay your rents. And now you're having to replace that with debt.
Yeah, so companies are essentially just being asked to take on more debt to get through this crisis, but they come out the other side of it even more indebted than they were in the first place.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if that debt is interest-free. It's still debt that's got to be paid back. And, whilst that might be better than going bust, I'm not so sure it solves the problem, which is keeping people in jobs. What's more than likely to happen is that business owners are just going to lay people off. There's already lobbyists within the hospitality area who are saying to the government, look, small business owners don't want to take on debt. And there's also, a question of how long it takes for all this kind of stuff to kick in. And this is probably explains one of the reasons why the stock markets are still going down. Because when you tell people to stay at home, and you get the drop in economic activity that produces, people buying less, spending less, you create a very difficult problem that's very hard to fix. And, you also, start triggering other issues. And I think the reason the British government's done this, just to sort of answer the second part or the first part of your question, is where does all the money come from? And that's difficult because since the financial crisis, where governments have just borrowed money and they've been able to borrow it for next to no interest rate because central banks have printed money and they've suppressed the interest that governments pay on their debt, we may be coming to a tipping point here where central banks can't print enough money to fund the amount of extra spending that's needed. And, you start to worry about interest rates going up, which creates all sorts of problems throughout the economy, which has got too much debt. And then you start getting into issues about currencies as well.
Well, the pound has taken a battering this week. And I guess that potentially creates the sort of environment for inflation as well.
Yeah, I mean, it does in terms of it pushes up the price of imported goods. Whether it creates inflation or not, I don't know, because the amount of goods coming into the economy is potentially going to fall by quite a bit. You've got this sort of deflationary force of people staying at home and economic activity going down, and then you've got currency effects. We'll see. I mean, one of the reasons the pound's been going down is it's not just people casting a verdict on the UK. I think there's been a huge demand for dollars. And so you've seen this huge demand for dollars, which has pushed up the price of the dollars against other currencies. And the pound has lost out because of that.
So the dollar, presumably because it's a safe haven, is attractive.
It's a safe haven, but you've also had a lot of demand by companies for dollars, for dollar financing. Not just in America, but also, across the world. And that has pushed up the demand for dollars. And you've seen something like what's known as a dollar index, which measures the value of the dollar against a basket of currencies, that has spiked in the last few days. And it shows you this flocking to the dollar.
I mean, it's something that, we've often said, get some diversification by looking at the US. Is it too late to do that? Should investors be thinking still about diversifying into US shares?
Yeah, I don't think it's too late at all. I mean, I'm of the view that, sadly, I know we might be having a bit of a rally on a Thursday afternoon as we're recording this. But, my view is that share prices are probably still going to keep on going down for a bit. So it's certainly not too late to build a watch list to start researching American companies. You know, I retain the view that investors out there should definitely be looking at this form of diversification, because I think what's been proven in the last 2-3 weeks or the last month is, you know, UK shares have been a horrible place to be.
Your portfolio valuations of the various big funds and benchmarks, FTSE All Share is down 33.6% year to date. And when you look at the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF, it's down, but it's down a lot less, 18.2%. Fundsmith down 11%. So you know, some of the big internationally diversified funds are doing a lot better than the UK benchmark index.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, there's a bit of a pound-dollar effect in there as well. Not a massive one, but a small one. Yes, this has been the theme for the last 10 years, really. You know, the FTSE 250, I mean, that's where the real fear is at the moment. You know, you look at some of the stocks in the 250, in certain sectors of the 250, you know, they've been decimated. Many shares there are being priced as if they are going out of business, and maybe some of them will.
We've talked about travel, leisure, obviously sectors that are, you know, massively dependent on people moving around or going out. They've obviously been hit hard, but what else is taking a battery?
I mean, anything travel related is continuing to suffer. I mean, it's amazing how quickly, you know, the travel-related stocks have just collapsed. I mean, I wrote a cover story in the Investors Chronicle last week, and I looked at some of these shares and I looked at their share price falls, and you look at them just over a week later and you just cannot believe, you know, some of them have gone down by a further 50% plus. Now, you're looking at shares like Cineworld, Marston's, Hollywood Bowl, W.H. Smith. I mean, these companies look like the end of the world is happening for them. And, you know, there's no doubt that these companies face, in the short term, very, very challenging trading conditions. But, you know, I think you can be pretty sure that, you know, you have a lot of people, you know, you have investors who specialize in distressed investing situations like you're seeing now in the sort of travel and leisure sector. Now, I'm not saying you go and buy these shares now, but, you know, if you are of the view that some of these companies will survive and that we will get back to normal and levels of activity and levels of profit come back to what they were earning last year, then these shares are screamingly cheap.
But as you write in your Alpha report, though, this week, Phil, forecasts are not worth anything right now. So we don't know what's going to happen in the next few months, but you can't honestly say that in a year's time, you know, even if an analyst is saying they're going to make what they did a year ago, that's actually going to be the case.
No. I mean, hence why, you know, I sort of looked at them on their historic levels of profit. And I think, you know, they aren't going to bounce back quickly. But if they do bounce back, then, you know, they look very, very cheap now, very risky. But, you know, also, you know, these are the kind of areas that, you know, the private investor can take their time and start looking at. You know, that's to buy them, but this is a good a time as any to build a watch list. I mean, you know, we mentioned WH Smith quite a lot on this podcast. You know, do I think WH Smith will go bust? I don't. I think it'll go through an incredibly rough time. You know, if people aren't travelling through train stations and airports and high street, it's going to be rough. You know, sadly, they've got a lot of they have a lot of hospital stores, and I imagine that, you know, they could get quite busy. But, you know, this is a business that, you know, when things are going well, it's a good company. I mean, Hollywood Bowl's another one. You know, they came out this week and said that their trading had been doing exceptionally well. You know, I think their like-for-like sales were up by 9%. But, of course, bowling alleys are not exactly the kind of places that people are going to right now. And that business is actually going to be temporarily closed down. But it could come back. It will come back. I mean, it enters this position with virtually no debt. You know, if you take away the leases and the rents, it has no debt. You would have to think that this is a company that probably can go to a bank and get cash flow to keep itself going. Yes, it comes back with a lot more debt or more debt, hopefully not a lot more debt. The economics pretty good. These things generate high profits, high amounts of free cash flow, and you could pay that debt back, and you could see this business getting back to something like what it was over, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years, and become quite interesting.
You know, right now, you don't want to be the banker that shuts down businesses that have suffered because of the coronavirus. It's a possibility that we won't see lots of businesses shut down because there will be a lot of forgiveness. You know, we're seeing lots of measures to protect tenants, to protect, you know, small shopkeepers. So you know, you wonder the same sort of approach will be extended to even large businesses like Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, even mentioned Cineworld last week. You know, I mean, Cineworld's a different kettle of fish in that it is loaded up with debt. But, you know, if you're a banker and you've lent money to these companies, you actually want to do everything you can to stop it going bust, because then it becomes your problem. And I think what the government and the Bank of England, you know, has done is that it's saying, look, they're standing behind the banking system and saying, look, we're going to stand behind the cash that you need to lend out to keep businesses going. And this is something that is different from 2008, when there was a big failure to do that quickly enough. And I think this is the positive thing, that businesses like this can survive, and hopefully will survive.
One thing that hasn't survived in a lot of cases is dividends. Unsurprisingly, when cash flow is at a premium, companies are not going to be giving that back to shareholders. So I guess a lot of people who are reliant on dividends for income are in a pretty bad place at the moment. What do you think they should be doing?
I mean, it's true. I mean, I think Next came out this morning, and that is a company that, quite rightly, a lot of people have high regard for, including me. And it was mentioning that one of its options to preserve cash was not to pay a dividend. And we've seen, you know, companies like Marston's come out and say it's probably not going to pay a dividend. Shoezone is another one. And it's no surprise that if you're going to be asking for cash, it's probably, if you can avoid paying it out, it means you don't have to ask for as much. And it makes a lot of sense. But I go on and say, look, there are sections of the market where I think that there are quite decent sources of dividend income. You know, I mentioned this last week in my main article in the Investors Chronicle. I think the water companies, and to an extent, electricity grid companies like National Grid, Scottish and Southern Energy, water companies are paying 4.5% to 5%. The electricity companies, 5 and a bit percent, 6% in SSE. They're not risk-free, but these are the kind of businesses that have got pretty secure income streams. And if people are given forgiveness for paying their electricity bills or paying their water bills, you would hope that the government would step in and provide the cash. We are in uncertain times. You can never say never in a market like this, but those are the kind of areas where you start thinking, yeah, you know, if I'm given the choice between, if I'm an income seeker, I mean, these have always been popular choices of income for investors, and I think they're not bad places right now.
And actually, we've got a feature coming out next week on this very subject, looking at companies paying dividends that are perhaps a little safer for those who are still in need of or looking towards equities as a source of income. Thank you very much. Good talking, Phil.
Thanks, John.
So I don't know about you, but I found that discussion really rather reassuring, that although we potentially face some very difficult weeks and months ahead of us, there is light at the end of the tunnel as the pharmaceutical industry finds its way towards a cure for COVID, and policymakers' interventions hopefully give us some economic hope as well, and that many companies that we cover, we write about a lot, will live to fight another day. As you probably noticed, this is a slightly different kind of podcast as well. As I mentioned earlier, we put the magazine together remotely. This week we've had to do the same, obviously, with the podcast. So apologies for any quality issues, but I think we've done it okay. There's lots and lots in the magazine this week, mostly COVID related. The news section obviously dominated by the outbreak, what it means for supermarkets, where we've seen lots and lots of incredible scenes this week of stockpiling. The insurance industry is a really one to keep an eye on. We've had a look at that and what happens there when people start to claim for the huge losses that they face as a result of the outbreak. We've actually got some non-COVID stuff. Philip Rynand is looking at acquisition accounting and Leonora Waltz is looking at VCTs. Lots and lots and lots of company results. We're still slap bang in the middle of results season and we're seeing lots of COVID-related news from the many, many companies reporting. And as well as that, we've got all the usual tips and comments. We've got some really interesting pieces from Mr. Bearble and Chris Dillo on COVID, what pandemics have done in the past and what this potentially means for our belief system. Thank you all for listening. Thanks again to Megan and Phil, even though they're not in the room here. And we will be back again next week, hopefully having worked out how to do this remote thing a little bit better. Thank you all and keep safe this week. Thank you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.